Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Sneha Navarapu, and I am the host of this channel. Today, I am thrilled to be in conversation with Dr. Ijlal Naqvi, author of the book Access to Power, Electricity and the Infrastructural State in Pakistan, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2022. Dr. Naqvi is an associate professor of sociology at Singapore Management University, and this is his first book. Welcome to our conversation.
Welcome, Ijlal. It's so great to have you on New Books Network, and I'm really excited to chat about your wonderful book, Access to Power. But before we begin, we would love to know more about you. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you became a sociologist, perhaps?
Sure. Hi, Sneha. Thanks so much for inviting me to be on the podcast. I've listened to you and the New Book Network many times. So it's fun to have a chance to talk about my work in this setting as well. Yeah. So my path to becoming a sociologist is a bit of a convoluted journey. I started out as an undergraduate studying economics, and I also did a minor in maths. Mm-hmm. From there, I think when I finished my BA, I remember asking myself very pointedly, where are the people? The best things I did in that time, or at least the most intellectually compelling ones, were one, I did an independent research project. And secondly, I took a political theory class, which got me thinking about, you know, sort of more compelling questions. But I was very much ready to be done with school. I became a business consultant, worked for about 3 years in the US.
Wow.
Making business models for cable companies that were transitioning from analog to digital systems. Right. So I spent a lot of time doing that until I realized, like, you know, this is really not for me. But in between, I had done some work for a government client. And I wanted to work with government, and I ended up in Pakistan, which is where I'm from. And I worked for the Ministry of Science and Technology, their IT and telecom division. And I think the 1 year that I spent there was important in so many ways, because the minister was a very dynamic personality. He had one advisor whom he relied on for sort of everything. And the advisor had basically two staff members, one secretary and me. So everything the ministry did was sort of channeled across my desk. It was a great place to be as a young person trying to figure out how government works. And after that, I did a master's degree in international affairs. That was at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. And there, I think stuff started to come together. Aisha Jalal was very influential, as well as Andy Hess. And they had me learning a lot more about the history and politics of the region of sort of Southwestern Asia, from Iran, Pakistan, and the Middle East more generally. And within there, I started to pull together a series of interests that were actually based in Iran. And I wanted to look at the institutional structure of the seminary system and the way that specific religious leaders rise in prominence and legitimacy and the kind of claims they can make on the public and the legitimacy that they have. So it was with that set of interests I connected with Charlie Kurzman, a sociologist at UNC Chapel Hill, who became my advisor. And I basically asked Charlie, does political sociology have a home for someone asking these kinds of questions? And he said, yes, very much so. So I ended up at UNC, and the first sociology course I ever took was the introduction to, you know, sort of sociological theory. in the graduate program, but thankfully it worked out well. Yeah.
That's great. And I love the textured journey that you have undertaken in your quest to becoming a sociologist.
I had no idea what I was doing at most points along the way, I think it's fair to say.
I mean, that gives me hope for it. But we would also love to hear from you how you came up with the idea for this particular book. So when did you start thinking about electricity in Pakistan, and how did those curiosities become a book project?
Yeah. So when I entered the sociology program, my interests were more in sort of things to do with Islam and democracy. Mm-hmm. I was very interested in pursuing a project that was based in Iran. I was learning Persian at the time. This was around 2005. Mm-hmm. The direction in Iranian politics at that moment made me feel like there was really very little chance of doing this project or doing this project safely, let alone as an outsider, as a foreigner. So I had to find something else essentially to do. And so from Iran, I moved towards Pakistan, where I think I had an advantage in terms of already having language proficiency. Mm-hmm. And I moved from studying the seminary system to thinking about a different look at like how how political claims are made with legitimacy, but I wanted to look at tax systems. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to do this in person. I wanted to collect data that involved me experiencing things firsthand. I think I was proficient with sort of quantitative approaches, but I also wanted to combine that with firsthand experience. Mm-hmm. And then after I thought more about tax systems, which is sort of at the heart of fiscal sociology and sort of well-established political questions. But my fear was that this would again be a very dangerous project to undertake, personally trying to ask questions about what kind of taxes they were or weren't paying in Pakistan. So I wanted to look at a way that the state mattered in everyday lives. This is another reason not to study taxes in Pakistan, because it's about 1% of the population who are paying direct income taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, many pay indirect taxes, but not direct taxes. Mm-hmm. So I wanted a way that the state mattered in everybody's lives on an everyday basis. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along wondering how I could find that, I realized that it was about electricity, because, from the lived experience of people in South Asia and all over the global South, irregular electricity supplies are very common. So I had, many personal memories of sort of like, oh, the light's gone again, sort of gather around in the living room with a candle, because that's literally all you could do. This is long before people had, backup power generators or truck batteries or, small scale photovoltaic systems like they do now. Mm-hmm. So this was a very tangible experience, one that mattered to me and one which everyone could relate to, because the other aspect of electricity is that for the most part, and I know there are exceptions, that rich or poor or whatever you're doing, industry, commerce, business, you rely on the state, you rely on the grid, you rely on a public utility to deliver service for you in Pakistan. And as anyone of any means in an environment like that, your first choice for yourself and for your family and for their well-being is typically to exit the state system for education, for transport, water supply, whatever you can do, you get out of public provision, whether it's low quality. But electricity, certainly at that time and still today, I would say, almost everybody relies on the electricity grid. Mm-hmm. And so that's what made me think that electricity was an appropriate way to explore the kind of questions that I was interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, as you were speaking about power cuts, I remember just joking recently with a friend of mine that my nieces, who are born in this post-generation, backup generation, generator sort of generation, mm-hmm. don't quite know what it's like to play Antakshari in the darkness, and have no concept of boredom, right? Like in that sense, where you're waiting for the power to come back. I think electricity and its various shortages shaped sociality in everyday life, absolutely, and so many critiques of the state in the everyday there. And you just mentioned that you were proficient in quantitative methods, but you really wanted to get a firsthand experience of these questions that you were asking. And I think that is reflected so very well in the methods that you use in the book project, right? So it's clearly mixed methods. There is quantitative analysis, but there's also like fabulous ethnographic data. So how did you go about collecting data for this book project? What were some of the issues you ran up against? And how did your social positionality shape your access to data?
Okay, thanks. for that. That's, I think, a fun question, because, again, it's like, in a book, I think all authors do this. We present it as if we were know what we were doing when we set out to write it, right? But I remember starting out the research, and the biggest challenge was, like, how do I get access to this sort of service delivery dimension of the electrical utility?
Right.
So that was one set of challenges, but the data wasn't available to me. And even the quantitative data wasn't available to me. And even as I spent extended amount of time in that system, I couldn't get the data that I wanted. So that's why, like, at least this was my dissertation project. At least at that time, it was entirely ethnographic and qualitative, but also looking at historical documents and such. Mm-hmm. So, I had proposed a mixed methods project, couldn't deliver it, but happily the quantitative side of it was sufficient to mm-hmm. start with. But my positionality there is complicated. And here, like, there's no way to answer that question except to give you, I think, more personal detail than might be expected. But, like, my father's Pakistani, but my mother's Austrian. So mm-hmm. Physically, in terms of caste and class markers, in a society which is very much colorist and has a set of orientations towards particularly Westerners that carry with them, colonial memories, and that it's like there's a lot that's going on there that's difficult to unpack. But basically, I straddle insider and outsider distinctions in my person just by showing up in a place. Like, I'm the one going to the field, but I might be the one who's actually exotic in that environment. Mm-hmm. So this is great for field work, I found, because mm-hmm. I can talk to people, and my Urdu is sufficiently proficient, and I'm going to speak it in a way that lets people know that I actually have a sense of local belonging. Mm-hmm. But they're going to look at me twice, because they're like, what is this guy doing here? Mm-hmm. Particularly in a distribution company utility office, where I'm not otherwise going to be. And so there are other aspects of that positionality, which are, like, for example, my family are Shia Muslims. And to someone with that background, or even most Pakistanis, they can tell by my name. Mm-hmm. So that revealed certain social networks, which were, I didn't exploit them intentionally, but falling into them, this became a great source of introductions from time to time. People would put me through their networks and process me in the way that they understood me, regardless of how I might be trying to present myself.
Right.
I was rather shameless in terms of, I think, like all good field workers, you talk to absolutely anyone and everyone who will speak to you.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk to me because I happen to have this last name, brilliant, that's good enough for me.
Sure.
And on we go. I had other people who tried to sort of proselytize and convert me into one particular sectarian identity or another, mm-hmm. which, those are awkward conversations, but you navigate all of that. Mm-hmm. But I found that simply being present in these spaces, there would be enough people willing to start talking to me that that I could navigate the conversation from there.
Mm-hmm.
But access to those spaces was very difficult to obtain. My only sort of introductions were at kind of the top level, because I'd previously worked in government. Mm-hmm. I knew some sort of senior level but retired officials. And from one, they connected me to the other. And until I had to sort of go down the hierarchy, it's relatively easy to get access to sort of policy level type people, but that wasn't the work I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to introduce me sort of downwards into the operational hierarchy of the utility. And there it was entirely who I could convince based on getting someone to think that I was a sufficiently harmless student, which I was,
mm-hmm.
until they would talk to me in enough detail to tell me about their work. And in terms of field work, it's like, frankly, you just show up again and again and again until you can see enough of things within the different domains of your interest.
Yeah.
Right. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but I haven't even touched on the quantitative data yet. I think it took me all of this experience, the ethnographic experience, to figure out which quantitative data I wanted, mm-hmm. who had it, and how to get it. And I did not get what I wanted until relatively recently.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so quick to write that chapter because I knew exactly what I wanted to do with it and how to work with it and the questions to ask with it.
Right.
But I didn't have the quantitative data. This was on Lesko until maybe a year or two before the book was published. But the other work was all done much beforehand.
No, and I think this is actually really useful to hear, especially as someone who is working on a book project right now. And actually, my historical chapter is a bit shoddy. And, you know, I keep thinking that I think I now know what I really want to look for. So it's become a lot more clearer, actually, post ethnographic fieldwork. Before that, it was just like looking for a needle in the haystack. And I'm like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to be looking for. But yeah, I think sometimes it's good to be reminded of the fact that fieldwork doesn't end with your dissertation, and sometimes like the most important data just like shows up much later than one might have imagined possible. So I actually appreciate the long-winded answer, mostly because it gives us a real sense of what fieldwork is like and how it all culminates into a fantastic book. So thank you. But so Access to Power, the book, and I really love the title, by the way, takes electricity production and distribution as a window into exploring the relationships of powers and processes of governance in Pakistan. You contend that you want to go beyond the tired narrative of state incapacity and actually scrutinize why reforms and political will to improve the power sector don't actually tend to produce positive outcomes. You show what is instead happening through a much more complex analytical layering of national, city level, and individual level logics. And the book's structure reveals this narrative strategy. And I really appreciated the funneling of the argument through this sort of part-by-part nested analysis. And one of the most compelling findings and arguments that you make in the book is that state capacity in Pakistan is chronically uneven, and that this unevenness works in specific ways to suit and benefit regions and groups that hold power, and inequality by design, as you put it. I hope to get into the nuts and bolts of that later in the interview, but for now, could you tell us a little bit about this unevenness being a strategy of state rule, maybe with an example, and also speak to how you position this argument in the classical and contemporary debates around state power and governance in the Global South?
Thanks, Sneha. Thanks for, you know, the question reveals the care with which you've digested the book. And I will try my best to address all of those points. So I think where I can start is the idea of the unevenness of state capacity in Pakistan and how it's a strategy of rule. And one thing that I found very striking when I was doing the analysis is that if you look at there's a national map of Pakistan in which I sort of shade the different regions according to the electricity losses that happen within that geographical area. And what you see is that, you know, sort of the Punjab operates in a more formal and efficient manner. And then Sindh and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa have sort of a lesser level of performance. And in Balochistan, it's even worse again. And when you, there's, you know, I look at losses and then also like who's actually paying their bills, it becomes even more stark that you see that the unevenness actually repeats patterns that we see throughout, you know, other aspects of Pakistani governance. And I think I try and make that claim because it's important for my book in terms of saying that electricity represents governance more broadly, certainly in Pakistan. And that map, like that map could be a number of things. It could be maternal mortality. It could be, you know, effective delivery of education, like which kids are functionally literate by a grade five. It's like the unevenness of the way that public goods are delivered across the entirety of the country is reflected in that map. And again, if we drill down into a more local level, what I found within a city area is that a similar degree of unevenness operates, that this inequality is chronic. It happens at multiple levels, that even within, say, the capital or Lahore, you'll find areas which are served very poorly in terms of electricity, and the utility simply isn't even able to collect its bills effectively. So one reason I call that inequality by design, which means really that that outcome is the product of the conscious and strategic decision making, even if people aren't deliberately choosing the specific outcome, all the steps along the way are considered and repeated. And they what they do is they reproduce relations of domination that exist in the country. Mm-hmm. What one does with that is to sort of contrast it against a notion that governance is driven by institutions, and that would imply that sort of institutions are weak in different places. And I think one thing that happens sort of at the national level, what you see is like actually the legal structures and sort of the organizational dynamics of organizational structures of these entities are completely the same, mm-hmm. right? Across the country. And what's more interesting is that within the city, it's like, it's not just that the organization is structured similarly, it's the same organization, the same people, the same physical infrastructure and equipment that mm-hmm. delivers these very different levels of service. And so what the state is not doing is the work of basically establishing a relationship with its citizens in these areas where it's enforcing on them a setting where they must pay their bills actively in order for service delivery to be complete. And that bad level of service delivery is matched by sort of a disengagement from different aspects of the population. And so that map reflects a differing degree of incorporation into the state and its functioning across multiple dimensions. But the one that I can measure specifically is electricity. So in terms of a specific example, I think it's worth looking at Balochistan. Balochistan is fascinating because it's been driven by insurgency across many time periods, but you know, still currently, mm-hmm. From the early 2000s till today. What you see is that almost no one in Balochistan is basically paying their bills, but the service delivery environment is equally terrible. Mm-hmm. And this translates directly into the complaints that the insurgents have about the manner in which their resources from their land are exploited for the benefit of others, and for which the Baloch people are not are benefiting appropriately. So in this way, it sort of maps directly into aspects of Pakistani nation building and the incompleteness and the ongoing process of that nation building as reflected in electricity. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You'll guide me if I missed out aspects of that. Excellent question.
No, this is great. And, you know, I would love for you to speak a little bit about how this sort of really interesting argument kind of speaks to the more traditional conceptions around state power and, you know, how you situate this argument in the larger domain around in political sociology, for instance.
Mm-hmm. So there, I think the strongest sort of work that influences particularly development approaches to development in both, I mean, perhaps less so development studies, which is mm-hmm. which is quite critical in many respects, but development right. as it is practiced, mm-hmm. Comes from this idea of governance being driven by institutions. And here, mm-hmm. I think, you know, we'll be perhaps talking about the World Bank and other development actors, more generally, this idea that Pakistan is insufficient in its institutions because it's not, you know, a Denmark and or you know, these sort of paragons of governance where our things work effectively, and if only we had better institutions, we could make that transition. Mm-hmm. It's not that, you know, I mean, anyone can recognize the failings of the Pakistani power sector are kind of well established by now.
Yeah.
And you don't by the time someone has spent a reasonable amount of time looking into it, you'll see like where the chronic problems arise and where they've continued to arise. Mm-hmm. But the ability to make that transition is what's absent. And it isn't about the way in which institutions are designed necessarily. To me, the way my argument fits what people are doing in political sociology is much more bringing in line with the politics themselves and the way that states effectively can be developmental mm-hmm. through a process which takes into account the motivations and expressed desires of, you know, their own populations in terms of their freedoms and capabilities, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So there's and here I think there's an idea that I put forward in the book about governance being emergent, and
right.
one reason I wanted to pick up on that is that the challenge of trying to transform a governance in a top-down way mm-hmm. Is that it's resistant to those things because it's historically contingent and shaped by these very strong political relationships which bind the underlying sort of nation together. Mm-hmm. And you have to look at this sort of sub-state level in order to begin to understand that. I think those are some of the directions that I wanted to push the discussion in political sociology.
Yeah. And that's really, really helpful. And it actually is a very neat segue into my next question, which is about how in chapter 3, you explore how development practice intersects with state power and capacity. And specifically, you explore a puzzle, right? The puzzle is that why is it that international development agencies like USAID, World Bank, Asian Development Bank support governance interventions in Pakistan despite persistent failures in achieving desired mm-hmm. outcomes in terms of a more expansive and equitable power distribution system? So I would love for you to speak a little bit about what explains this puzzle.
Yeah, and I think I should mention one little bit of background there, mm-hmm. which relates to how I did this project, is that I had been in Pakistan throughout my field work. I didn't actually return to Chapel Hill to write up. Mm-hmm. I did my writing up while I was based in Pakistan, and I took a job as a development consultant for the USAID project, which is working on governance reforms.
Right.
I did that for multiple reasons, but what it was great for me in terms of putting me into this apparatus. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was employed as a contractor under a USAID consultant. I was on this energy policy project, and I was physically sitting in the Ministry of Water and Power, working on the public sector governance reforms program for electricity. Mm-hmm. So I was right in that environment. It was brilliant in some respects because it gave me a lot of personal access to the people who were doing this work. Mm-hmm. And those people do similar kinds of work in other locations. Some of them had done similar kinds of work in Pakistan, because once you dig into it, you realize that the positions taken by these international development actors are quite consistent over time. Mm-hmm. And the thing that they aren't confronting typically is that their policies are not being implemented. And they're well aware of that. It's a source of frustration, and it's typically blamed on political will. And I think, you know, to blame it on political will is rather it's a cheap exit from grappling with the strong, powerful reasons why states act the way they do, mm-hmm. Even when it means persisting with an inefficient power sector, mm-hmm. right? Like at the time that I was there, one of the many things that was posed was that, okay, we'll disband the unions because, mm-hmm. you know, they'll interfere with our desire for reform.
Right.
It's like, okay, great. What are we talking about? 100,000 mm-hmm. plus public sector employees? You think this is going to go easily?
Yeah.
You know, and that discussion didn't go anywhere. Then, you know, there was because of the strength of the resistance, but also the manner in which the approach to institutional reforms proceeds. So by that, I mean, the only way that an entity like USAID can do that kind of work is that they have to hire private sector consultants, because mm-hmm. they don't have the capacity themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
They just literally don't have enough people to run a project like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they put out a tender, it has to be a competitive tender. And among the many things that a bid will be evaluated on is the track record of that entity in delivering similar projects elsewhere. So what pretty much has to happen is that the contractor that comes in will have this decontextualized knowledge that they bring to apply within this local environment. And mm-hmm. so the contractor themselves actually doesn't keep all the people on staff. They have their own sort of human resource effort of then, you know, putting in a bid, locating people with appropriate CVs, then trying to engage them on this project. And all of this kind of ad hocism means that people come in typically without a great deal of local knowledge, but they are versed in what it means to do power sector reforms elsewhere. And then the contractor is bound by strong terms and conditions, obviously because they've bid on a contract, now they're expected to deliver it. And then you add another dimension to it when in a very sort of politically sensitive environment, like, you know, this is during the global war on terror, when the United States is giving a substantial amount of aid money to Pakistan to do projects like this.
Right.
The congressional scrutiny on projects like that is severe. Mm-hmm. So you're also, I'm not even necessarily saying that that's a bad thing. Like, if I was an American taxpayer, wouldn't I also want to know where my government's sending its money? But what this means is that it's incredibly difficult for the person who's involved in sort of the policy reform effort to do anything that's sort of a very contextually informed and a little bit dynamic, right? They're very much bound by the things that they've committed themselves to, that they're bound by the things that the terms of reference are compelling them to do. Mm-hmm. And they're working on a tight timeline where a lot of their interest is towards spending money within a certain amount of time, for example, the burn rate. So within development studies, these things are well critiqued. And there was a brilliant article by Andrew Natsios who sort of looked at this, and I cite it. And he describes a counter bureaucracy, like the level of scrutiny means that within that setting, it's very hard for the consultants to even do that work effectively. But I want to mention that, you know, I worked alongside these people. They're deeply knowledgeable about the power sectors, you know, power sectors internationally, how these systems work, some of the problems that happen in them. And they, like to me personally and to this project, they gave a lot of brilliant feedback, which made my work better. Unfortunately, we did not achieve the governance reforms that we were all there to do, but we did have brilliant conversations about the power sector, what was wrong with it, and what might have been a better approach.
Thank you. That's really very, very interesting. And it does begin to make us think more expansively about like what kinds of questions we want to ask about failure, right? And I'm thinking also of like you thinking through James Ferguson's questions around like how we ask better questions around what comes across as a failure of these sorts of projects, right? And really like rethinking the very analytical apparatus that we use to evaluate what is going on.
Exactly. I know I cite James Ferguson, but like I don't think I felt like that was one of the influences on my approach to this work, is like the idea that Pakistan works actually, like, you know, even though by many metrics the state is doing a terrible job at these things, like there are consequences, and those consequences are not accidental in the way that they're sustained and the patterns that reproduce themselves over time.
And the consequences are perhaps not even in the purview of the goals that are stated on paper, but they have like different kinds of consequences. And so rethinking what we mean by failure is very, very useful, I think. And the way you've talked about it is, of course, different from what Ferguson did, but I think it has a similar kind of similar kind of rethinking that we can use in the questions that we ask. But for someone like me who loves thinking about infrastructure and urban governance, Chapter 5 was extremely, extremely interesting. I was so taken by it. And in this chapter, you scrutinize how residents of a Kachi Abadiya squatter settlement in Islamabad attempt to formalize their claims for individual electricity meters. And you compare these experiences with relatively affluent Islamabad residents who already have these formal rights. Could you speak about what this comparison yields in terms of our existing understandings of formality and informality in the face of an uneven state capacity?
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Neha. I had the Kachi Abadi experience was a really interesting one for me, because this was in the environment where more than anyone else, the people talked about their rights. We have a right to this, we have a right to that. And of course, it's the people who are denied formal access who are most conscious of what they're being denied. And so when I spoke to them, they described themselves as being on the cusp of achieving regularization, which means that they would all be sort of formalized in their occupancy. And they were in an intermediate stage at that point in time, which meant that they weren't necessarily going to get kicked out, but they also didn't have full access to formal sector rights, which would have included an electricity meter. You couldn't get an electricity meter without a no objection certificate, which meant that you were a legal occupant of the land. And so long as that occupancy wasn't regularized, they couldn't get the individual electricity meters. Mm-hmm. And they wanted it, and they articulated that desire in language that could have been ripped straight out of the World Bank sort of textbook, you know, practically quoting Hernando de Soto. Like, they wanted that so that their land would become more valuable, and think about the ways that I can invest in my property and so on and so forth. Yeah. We can improve the way we live with formal rights.
Yeah.
Which was fascinating to me to hear that argument articulated through the squatter settlement residents. Within that setting, they had a communal arrangement, which was itself highly unorthodox against the formal rules of the state. But it was the way that a sort of like compromise had been achieved, where they were provided electricity that they could pay for. Mm-hmm. But they had to manage the distribution of it internally. So some families within that environment, right, were able to get a meter of their own, mm-hmm. an individual formal meter. And I mean, I don't know exactly how they achieved that, but, you know, they have done so. But some of them, at least, what they found was that they've entered into now a different set of relationships with the state, which they were ill-equipped to navigate, mm-hmm. right? The one young man I spoke to described himself as insufficiently educated to handle the bureaucracy, that the paperwork, like once he was given a false bill, which I couldn't verify, but I'm pretty sure that was correct, and this is standard practice for the electricity company, that they will basically park consumption on somebody else's bill because they're basically allowing it in a different location. It's a way of facilitating loss and making the record keeping, the books of the electricity company look less bad.
Right.
So he'd clearly, to me, it was clear that he'd been a victim of that, but he couldn't navigate the formal bureaucracy. So what that family chose to do was go back to using the communal meter, right? Mm-hmm. Because they felt more protected within that environment, even though there are all manner of predation that can happen within that setting as well. Mm-hmm. The experience of formality was not necessarily an advantage to them. So that was one thing that came out. Mm-hmm. Is that even though that was clearly what they wanted, and even though it's also very evident that the people with better levels of service delivery have formal arrangements with the state, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that transition is difficult to navigate. And then so what the affluent residents revealed to me was that in order to both secure service delivery and sustain it in a manner that's useful to them, they had to use all manner of informal connections with the state. Just because you are middle class, wealthy, educated, and all the rest of it doesn't mean that you simply approach the state without tafarish or whatever else it is. Like, your first sort of action in that setting would be to figure out, who do I know, so that they can connect me and deal with me as a human being rather than as someone who will be exploited and victimized. Yeah. And so from both sides, it's like the informality was inevitable. Mm-hmm. And the dangers of formality, I think the risks entailed in it are something that's been hasn't been fully recognized in the literature. So it was a very instructive experience for me.
Yeah. And, you know, I was reflecting back on some of the conversations I had during fieldwork, which was also an ethnographic exploration of the everyday manifestations of state power and authority, but through the lens of traffic and driving, right? So, like, yet another experience, right. I think, that vexes a lot of citizens in Global South.
Absolutely.
But it was something similar in the sense of how it was both middle class and elite aspiring motorists, as well as low-income working class motorists who were bribing state officials, but for very different rationales and reasons, right? But like the general outcome was similar. Like, it wasn't as if there was one class of people who were somehow having these non-personal and formal engagements.
Exactly.
To see that reflected in a very different empirical and infrastructural context was very instructive. Like, I think there's something going on here that hopefully more of us will, you know, explore in political sociology, just to kind of push back against this notion of informality being related to specific class, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. The informality is that pervasive that we're all engaged in it. And, you know, people who are of that, I think if you've lived in certainly South Asia, people will immediately recognize this experience.
Absolutely. And in that vein, the next chapter, chapter six, focuses much more on an individual level experience of the state and addresses how, as we just actually talked about in a previous question, how governance is an emergent compromise, which I really thought was a very provocative and powerful idea. So in this chapter, you show through ethnographic vignettes how government bureaucracy functions under real life constraints and how, as you put it, codified rules are wrapped in layers of social negotiations and contestations. In the chapter that follows chapter six, which is chapter seven, you add another layer to this analysis by showing how culture shapes behavioral interactions in a public office oriented towards service delivery, such as the Islamabad Electricity Supply Company. So could I invite you to tell us generally, broadly, more about these constraints and the culture that animate bureaucratic worlds in Pakistan? And also, how can we think about governance as being emergent? What are the analytical affordances of viewing governance as emergent?
Great. Another great question. So I think there's different aspects to it, but let me start with the idea of governance as being emergent. And so it comes from, or it maps to this idea that I'm looking at the state as a set of nested fields, right? So these are sort of vertically or hierarchically nested, that the individual exists within a city, within a national level environment. And within each sort of field, each level of analysis, the process is very dynamic and driven by power relationships. So, you know, the way that rules are interpreted and implemented is itself influenced by the relative standing of the players, of the different actors within that setting. And so and given that it has these sort of multiple levels, right, the fact that it's emergent means that the way that the rules are operating, sort of the rules of the game in a classic Northian institutional sort of understanding, like these can't entirely be predicted beforehand. So this is another limitation on how we need to see formal or black letter law rules and understand them, right? The national, city, and individual level experiences are influencing each other. Like these patterns belong with each other. It's tying back to, you know, sort of questions of governance reform and their viability, in that those things are almost always conceived at a national level, sort of pointing downwards. And the complaint of a lack of political will seems to come about when it just because like a rule is written or an instruction is given. And it isn't being implemented. I mean, it isn't being implemented for good reasons. I think those kinds of changes put an unreasonable pressure on the SDO, the subdivision officer, who is the officer in charge of local service delivery for, you know, it might be 25,000 households. Mm-hmm. It's like, is there really any serious expectation that that individual can now compel, you know, everyone from police stations, government offices, and so on to now pay their bills, let alone like wealthy individuals, politically connected individuals, and all the rest of it. It's just a completely an unreasonable approach to how those institutions work at a ground level. Right. So these like emergent compromises are necessary to engage with and understand if one wants to both, you know, recognize how the lived experience of everyday encounters with the state takes place, and also how one might go about changing it for the better. All right. So that was the emergence side of it, and why I think that it's important for governance to be considered emergent. And I think the analytic affordances that it uses, very nice phrase, by the way, is that it's pushing you to recognize recognizing the limits of sort of top-down interventions. It's kind of sad because anyone who's engaged with development on a practical basis, it's like the first thing that anyone will realize. No one will advocate for it. And yet the systems only seem to work by enabling top-down intervention, right? And so the analytic insight, I think, clearly is like, how does one navigate those local level dynamics and create change within that environment?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So separately, we talked about the culture within which or what we're learning about culture through studying these behavioral interactions in a public office around around IESCO. And so we're learning, I learned a lot. I mean, I talked to a lot of the utility employees, the very low level ones, line superintendents and below, assistant linemen and so on. And they, you know, they're themselves in situations where their pay is so minimal, right? At the time that I was there, I think, you know, the cash pay for one of those sort of low-level officers might have been the equivalent of about $100 a month. And the only, and they did get benefits, and obviously access to benefits was a key sort of condition for them to be able to live well. But their housing, their sort of the strategies for well-being were only effective at a household level, right? Which means that this one individual who worked in the formal public sector could bring other benefits to a family, which was also going to have to bring in resources from other directions, right? But it meant that their role within the family setting was often about using their own public position for the benefit of themselves and their family so that they can achieve a decent standard of living, right? There, I mean, there are always sort of urban legends about, you know, millionaire linemen and things like that. But this was certainly not true of the people that I encountered, right? But what I found was that I was originally apprehensive about, like, how do I talk to them about what's normally called corruption, like the how money in particular eases certain transactions or makes them possible. And I never, almost never needed to ask anybody about it. They would tell me. And they would tell me in a very matter-of-fact way that because it was tied to the impossibility of them doing their job without some of that pay. And that's because, for example, as part of their job, they would be required to go around different locations in the city, but they didn't have transport provided to them. If they did have transport, that transport didn't have petrol, right? An allowance for petrol to take them around. So the only way to make that money, to make that system even function at the rudimentary level that it was working, is for these people to be taking some manner of money. But they were quite, they had a, the people that I encountered, they had a strong sort of moral understanding of what they were doing. And they were very conscious of it. And they were conscious of presenting themselves as not taking money in a manner that hurt the organization or authority that they were working for. So it's one thing to take money to expedite someone's paperwork, right? That was, you know, sort of considered par for the course. But it, what they didn't want to do, or what they really looked down on, was someone who would basically steal a whole bunch of cable and sell it, right? So they were aware of people who would do that sort of thing, and they looked down on them. And it's a culture, it's collective, because none of this is happening individually, right? It happens within an environment where this is a norm. And for an individual to opt out of it is not only difficult in terms of how do they make a livelihood, but to be the one officer, the one individual in a setting of perhaps 100 people who refuses to play along is quite dangerous. And that individual will probably be in very difficult circumstances. I don't mean physical threats, but they'll be sidelined through some kind of administrative procedure sooner or later. And this applies just as much to someone in the middle of that hierarchy as to the top of that hierarchy. You can't avoid that. So their participation is, in effect, necessary and expected, and deviating from that is difficult, right? So there's a whole set of cultures around that practices, around those practices, which the bureaucratic employees engage in, and then they're approached very much with those expectations, and so people are ready quite often to deploy their own social connections to make things work for them, or make transactions easier by paying for certain things.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, as I was reading this chapter, I'm actually teaching a class on the political sociology and anthropology of the state. And I was making a mental note to include this chapter in the week on bureaucracy because I think it's such a,
Thank you.
such a, yeah, and it's such a vividly ethnographic chapter, which I think students will learn a lot from in terms of these sorts of like questions around like culture and morality that come up and animate the, and we're reading it alongside Bourdieu's bureaucracy, right? Which paints such a
Oh,
different
wow.
picture of like
Yeah.
of objectivity or like, or even Weber's work, right? And it, this is like such a big departure from theories of bureaucratic work as dispassionate and objective and, or disinterested in that sense. So yeah, I'm looking forward to teaching it next year. I didn't I'm teaching Akhil Gupta this year, but I think this would be
Oh,
such
yeah.
a compliment to those discussions.
Yeah.
But thanks so much for talking about these chapters in the book, and I really enjoyed the accessibility of the book. Like I thought it was such complex ideas written in a very clear, concise, and readable manner, and I really
Thank you.
appreciated that. But I actually wanted to end the conversation with learning a little bit about what you're working on right now and what we can hope to read by you in the near future.
Okay. Well, thanks for your interest in the book, and be delighted if you did assign it to your students, and please tell me what they think of it. Having done all this work on electricity in Pakistan, one of the things that I sort of discovered a little later on was in connecting to the Karachi Electric Utility. And what's happened in Karachi is quite remarkable because it was privatized, or rather put under private management in the around 2004, 2005, and then run by a private equity group since then. But what this private management managed to achieve was a really radical sort of progress in terms of the key performance indicators of the company, that their losses have fallen from above 30% to now below 20%. I'm very interested in understanding how they've done that. I've done a little bit of work there in looking into it, and it's revealing some really interesting answers because, just as we were talking about governance as emergent and what this means in terms of the analysis that it affords for governance reforms. What I'm learning about the Karachi Electric Utility is that they really did a nice job of combining a role for local political leaders and social influential individuals to making their reform effort successful. They didn't try and impose it in too much of a top-down manner, but they worked very well with sort of local parties. And so, it's too complex a story to simplify it that way, but certainly and one thing I want to try and figure out or like test more empirically is that how did they achieve this outcome? Were they able to actually transform the behavior of individuals and their relationship with the utility, or were they able to, or did they do the easy thing of simply transferring service more aggressively to serve the industry and wealthy individuals and just, improve their performance by neglecting the poor? And actually, there's a lot of evidence which suggests that they've changed the relationship with a wide variety of the city. But the other interesting thing of that experience in Karachi was that when privatization originally happened, the backlash was tremendous. There were riots, there was violence from the unionized workforce, and at least 4 or 5 years, I think, it was sort of a cautionary tale against the possibility of privatization. And that's really the other aspect of why I want to look into it, is that privatization is so often put forward as this simplistic solution to everything that could be wrong with the public sectors, and particularly in Pakistan. And yet we're not, if they did the hard work of making that change effective, then we need to understand what it is. And so that's another aspect of it, is that I would like to tell a story which has hopefully some more constructive lessons. And then being able to do it in a way which combines different types of data, because one thing that I'm getting from Karachi Electric is the is spatial data. So I'm able to represent it on maps, which is a different way to communicate the message of what's happening in the city and what has happened. So that's the project that I have in mind. But I mean, it's a longer one, but it's what I'm looking forward to working on for the next couple of years.
That's amazing. And that sounds really, really interesting. And I look forward to reading what comes out of this project. All the best for that. And again, once again, congratulations on this book. And I hope you're taking your time to celebrate it and, you know, to revel in the glory of the book having been published.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good feeling. Thank you for your interest in the book and for arranging this interview. It's really been a pleasure to talk about it with you.
Thank you, Vishal. Take care.
You too.